All right, so we're recording. So, welcome to another Square and Compass podcast episode. We are here at a place that's very near and dear to my heart. I'll talk about that in a second. We're here with Michael Fish, archivist for the City of Windsor through the Windsor Public Library. Coming up to a pretty big anniversary for you.
Coming up to 22 years of working for the library, yeah.
That is very cool. Has it always been as an archivist?
Yes, I was hired in 1979 as the processing archivist, originally, and 4 years later I took over as archivist when that current archivist retired.
I've talked about this in a lot of podcasts. The thing I love about Freemasonry is you make so many connections with people. Sometimes not even they don't have to be involved in Masonry themselves to make a connection with them. And certainly in your case, right, I connected with you, it would be last year now, when I was looking up the original blueprints for the Windsor Masonic Temple for a video I did.
Right.
Being so involved with the historical building as the Windsor Masonic Temple, and which has such like a treasure trove of there's just so many historical documents in that building. It really got me thinking about the importance of historical documents and for a city, for a region, and the preservation of those, which is why I wanted to have you on, because 22 years, you're going to have a lot of stories, I'm sure, and a lot of very valuable insights into that subject. How much has things changed? Just thinking back, you said you started in
1979. I said 1999.
That makes way more sense. Yeah. I was like, wait a second. Although I still have a hard time thinking. When I think 20 years ago, I think it's like 1980. I have a hard time recognizing 20 years ago as 2000. How much have things changed, though, in that time from 1999 to now? Has there been, I mean, I know you're in a new building, but changes with technology or?
The archives is still very much paper-based. Most of the records here are still paper, which I have very little word in terms of electronic records. But we're putting more and more material online over time. We've scanned all our print photographs, and we're now in the process of putting those available online as well through the Windsor Public Library's website. So to make it accessible for anybody with a computer, obviously, to access our photographs.
What is it that got you interested in history, in archives?
Well, originally history itself, probably steam locomotives of the railways. I was always fascinated as a kid of that kind of machinery and things like that. And that's the history of railroading in Canada and the United States. In terms of kind of making a jump to archives, I'd applied to come to here to grad school to do a master's in history. And the grad counselor talked about the archival program at Windsor, which I wasn't really aware of at the time. And when I finished talking with him, I looked more into it and I said, well, it gives me something I can use when I graduate from school. And through the program, I was more and more interested in the whole business of preserving records and making them available to the public. And being able to go through these historic records and old papers and diaries and newspapers and things like that. I just found it very fascinating.
How important, you know, I think I always had like an intuitive, idea that preservation of historical documents was important for a city, for a region. But it's not really until I became involved in the Masonic Temple and started spending so much time there that I think it really hit it home for me anyways, the value of these things. But from your perspective, you know, what is the value of, you know, preservation of archival documents, and not only the preservation of them, but then making them available to the public?
Well, obviously it's highly important because those are the records, they're the history. There's the backbone of where we are today, right? We kind of hear about the decisions that were made in the past. So, you know, the archives here holds municipal records for the city of Windsor. So you're looking at how we got to whatever point in the city's past. You can go back to those records and say, okay, these are the decisions that were made and the reasons why these decisions were made. So it's important to keep those records just to get an understanding of how we became Windsor and that kind of thing and how we've evolved over time.
Do you... So I like that. I wouldn't mind talking about that a bit more because I like what you said there. It's not just the record itself, but that record shows how decisions were made and how we evolved, how Windsor evolved to the place where it is now. So from a research perspective, if somebody, what are some of the ways in which these documents can help like illuminate that?
Well, I mean, we've got like council minutes. So obviously, if you're looking at what council was doing 100 years ago, so you can go through the council minutes and see the kind of thinking that was going on at that time, the decision making that was happening, that kind of thing. I mean, even like architecture drawings, those kind of things, the styles that were in place at the time that the eras were. Taking place and things like that. So, if the Amazonic Temple was being built today, it would probably be a different style than the building you have now, right? And so it's just, you get that change in time frames and things that the record will show.
Do you, I've always wondered, because we're talking about, documents that go back centuries, what type of work goes into the actual preservation of these documents? I know you mentioned you're digitizing them, put them up online, but is it a constant battle with the elements, with moisture, with?
It is, can be, definitely. Obviously, everything degrades over time, so we can't stop it from degrading. What we try to do is slow it down as slow as possible. So we do things like we put the records into acid-free boxes or in acid-free file folders. We try to keep the temperature and the humidity in this space consistent, things like that. Just slow the process of deterioration down. We try to minimize the handling of the documents, because the more often you handle the documents, there's a greater chance they're going to get torn. Of course, dirt from your hands, oils from your hand also help to accelerate the deterioration. Those kind of things that we do to try to just trying to make it so that in 200 years, 300 years, you can still look at the original architectural drawings for the Masonic Temple kind of thing. And that's the goal, is to basically maintain this material in the best conditions possible for future generations of Windsorites or Canadians to view.
It's got to be very, very rewarding. What are some of the documents that you've come across in your time that stand out for you? Is there anything in particular that you remember finding and preserving?
The probably most interesting document that I've come across, and they're actually very well used extensively here, is the fire insurance plans. And these were very detailed maps that showed kind of the footprint of each building in the city and color-coded, so you knew when you looked at it whether it was built with wood or with brick or concrete, this kind of thing. And these maps were, I find, particularly fascinating. And we have a series of these maps over a number of decades. So you can see the change in the neighborhoods looking at these maps. And these maps are used quite extensively today by environmental companies who are looking at doing the history of properties. Somebody's looking to buy a property, seeing what was there in the past. They show like if there's tanks that are buried or whatever in the ground or what its use was. So they get used quite extensively. Those are the part of the most I found very interesting. I've also had an interest in cartography as well. So they just kind of also played up my interests, these maps.
How do records come to the archives?
Generally, one of two ways. With municipal records, they are transferred from the various departments here. If the public they can make a donation, they'll call and say, I've got these records, or are you interested, that kind of thing. That's basically how we get them here, either through donations or through transfer from the municipality itself.
There have been any really cool finds, stuff that people discovered maybe when they're renovating a house, or records that are lost that are rediscovered that have come your way?
Not too much. I usually get people calling saying they've got newspapers. They found, like, I've had people call because they found, and they're stripping a house, and they found newspaper was used as insulation. And they wonder if I was interested in getting the newspapers. I'm not really interested in that kind of stuff. So nothing that way in terms of any great finds like that were exciting that I, unfortunately.
What about the move here? That's something interesting. We are doing this at the Archives, which is 85 Pitt Street East. Before this, you were located at the central branch of the library when it was on old ed.
Correct.
How was that? Because that's not that long ago. It's been, what, just over a year?
Just under a year. We moved at the end of November of last year.
How was that? I was just thinking about, I'll take some pictures of the archives themselves, but the actual process of moving so many important documents, dealing with, like you mentioned, you know, we've got to keep them dry and transporting them. Some of them are probably pretty fragile. Just what was that like, the actual move and protecting these documents?
Well, basically, they obviously hired a moving company to do that. And the company did was they had these book trucks, large book trucks. And so the boxes were put in the book trucks, and then they wrapped them in plastic. And the book trucks, of course, are on wheels. So they would just roll them, once they've been wrapped and protected in this plastic, they'd roll them on the truck, drive them over here and unroll them and unwrap them. And then they place them on the shelves after the shelves have been moved here. So they have to empty all the shelves first, move the shelves here, and transfer the material over to the new location, and then put them back on the shelves. And it took approximately 2 weeks.
And how you liking the new digs? And if other people want to swing by the archives to look, to do some research, look some historic records up, how do they go about doing that?
Well, they can come and visit the archives. They are, right now, it's by appointment only. So they would need to get a hold of me either through email or by phone and arrange an appointment. Because if I'm not here, then the archives isn't open. So it's just best just to call ahead, even because I may not be around, and then just showing up at the door kind of thing. Unfortunately, due to COVID right now, we're only allowing one person in at a time. And another way is a lot of it is just emails. People just ask questions. Do you have this material? If you do, can you scan it and email it back to me kind of thing? So those are, you know, visits or by email is usually the most common way people access the records.
And what type of requests do you normally get? I know you mentioned the fire plans, mm-hmm. Environmental groups looking at those.
Right.
What are some of the other type of requests you get frequently? Are a lot of students looking for information?
I get a few students, PhD students usually in most cases. I do. There's a lady from Queens is looking at coming down sometime in the winter or spring term to do research. And that can run from, I had a gentleman from Germany doing research on business relationships between Windsor and Detroit. I had another gentleman doing his PhD on the attitudes to Canadians towards Americans during the First World War, before the Americans got involved in the war and then after, and how their opinions changed towards Americans after they even got involved in the First World War. In terms of general public, one of the big questions I have is, people looking doing home histories, people looking, they buy a building or something like an apartment building or a business, and they want drawings for the building. So I get a lot of requests for drawings.
That's fascinating. Walk me through that process of, let's use the student who wants information on relationship between Canadian and American businesses and the changing. So when somebody contacts you and has that specific, that inquiry, for example, mm-hmm. what's the process then? What are some areas that you're going to look at in your archives?
Well, I would obviously go through and look at the various collections we have, which are now available online, and suggest you know, I don't generally know what they might give me this broad topic that they're looking for a relationship, but beyond that, I wouldn't know exactly what they're looking for. So I might suggest various collections that I have that might be related to businesses, corporate records that may be here. I'm just trying to think of what this gentleman looked at when he was here. That was quite a long time ago. There might be some, we have development commission records. I know he went through those kind of thing. So anything that related to the topic, I can suggest. It would be up to, obviously, this person doing the research, whether that's relevant to what they want, they're looking for, correct? So that's all I can do. I can say, I just try to guide the researcher to the resources that are here. And quite often when they're here, they're doing this, oh, do you have this kind of thing? That generates other questions. And I can say, yeah, I've got something that might be relevant to what you're looking for, or I don't have anything, unfortunately, or something like that.
I love the maybe because I never really grew up, I'm still a kid, the detective aspect of it. I think it's so neat because you come in with this general idea, you know, I want to learn more about the relationship between Canadian American businesses, or in my case, I want to learn more about the Windsor Masonic Temple,
right,
and see those blueprints. And then, you know, the direction it takes you and the road it takes you down, it's so, things you wouldn't think of necessarily, you know? Like when you mentioned that, I never would have thought to come to the archives to learn about the relationship between American businesses and Canadian businesses. But obviously, like you mentioned, there's going to be business records, there's going to be corporate minutes, there's going to be even city council will be talking about
right.
those things.
Yeah.
So I guess, how do you, I guess you have to be a very incredibly organized person. I feel like so much would feel like a needle in a haystack if you get a broad topic, like business relationships or things of that. When you try to sit down and you get a broader topic to research or requested by somebody, what kind of, do you have a process in mind? Do you think about how I'm going to proceed with this?
If it's a very broad topic, depending on what they're trying to get, usually I'll try to determine what answer they're looking for. You know, if somebody were to walk and say, I'm interested in the history of Windsor, well, I'll start with box one. You know, obviously that's not a very efficient way to go about it. In that case, they're probably looking for more of a narrative. So they're looking for like a local history, you know, looking for books on Windsor as opposed to specific answers. So I say when you come into an archive, the more specific that the question you can ask, the easier it is for me to help you. Otherwise, I try to narrow it down because it's too broad and just where do you start? So then you can start kind of in the specific and then you can kind of work your way from there.
I you used a word I want to go back to, narrative. I think that is a really important word in historical research, in history, even just in the history of our buildings. I went to, it was virtual due to obvious circumstances, the National Trust and APT, Association for Preservation Technologies Conference, which was held virtually. And one thing that they really emphasized was when you're talking about a heritage property or heritage, anything related to a heritage property, really what you're trying to emphasize is the stories of people who were at that property. And how they connected with that property and what it meant to the people in the city, in the region, in the whole area. So when, for example, I look at the blueprints for the Windsor Masonic Temple, right, I don't just see the piece of paper, but when I'm looking at the blueprint for the ballroom, I try to picture the narratives of all the people who were in that ballroom for weddings and dances.
Right, the various events that took place. Yeah.
Do you find the same thing, like, especially being here for almost 22 years, I guess, how do you connect the physical pieces of paper, the blueprints, the plans, the records, to the people themselves and the narratives that they have, their stories?
I guess a lot of times when I look at, you know, architectural drawings, particularly, I try to envision what they were used for, what potential use they were. I've had students who've come from St. Clair College, and one of their projects is to reimagine a structure into something else, being used for something else. So they look at the architectural drawings. So they're trying to look at these drawings, and they're maybe built for some other use, and they're trying to imagine what another use could be used for that building. You know, the, currently 850 Yalette right now, it's, you know, it's sitting empty, the old central library. What's, you know, what kind of structures could be, activities could be used in that space, kind of thing. I don't know if I spent a lot of time imagining what something was used for to make that kind of connection, because that's really the historian's job to kind of create that narrative. We provide, what we do here is we provide the records, the grounding to create that narrative. That's, it's not so much my job to create the narrative for them. That's what the researcher does.
I just making sure you have, though, like you said, right, having the foundation on which you create that narrative is, you know, is the documents and is right. the preservation of those documents. Do you have any, on your almost 22 years, anything that stands out for you as the archivist? Anything that you're particularly proud of, or work that's been done, or anything even that you're looking forward to moving forward?
I'm proud of this new space. I think this is a great space. We're no longer in the basement of Central Library. There used to be sewer lines going through the old storage area. So I'm proud of getting this moved here and set up in a relatively quick amount of time. I'm just looking forward to eventually getting beyond COVID and getting back to normal operations and, you know, being open to the public, just public service hours, you know, that kind of thing. And so people can just drop in and instead of having to make an appointment, which a lot of people don't want to have to do. They find it a bit of a hassle having to make an appointment, that kind of thing. Especially if they just have a quick question they want to ask.
Have you ever, do you have any stories about people discovering something really meaningful to them, or you're discovering a narrative that had special meaning to them? One of those, you know, light bulb moments?
I can't remember any particular spots, but I do remember people saying, oh, you know, they're coming across. I did have a gentleman from Kitchener. He was doing military research, and he was going through the Bruce McDonald collection, and he found letters to another person he was interested in, and he didn't realize we're here. And that was kind of this light bulb. Oh, great, you have these letters to this and other individual, kind of thing. And he wanted to do more further research on that individual as well. So something like that. So a lot of times they find something they didn't know was here when going through the various files or, you know, records. Yeah.
And we talked about it before, but we should mention again the type of services the archives provide. So obviously you talked about people needing to, right now anyways, create an appointment to come in to review historical documents, but also what if they want to, you know, if they want copies of those documents, photocopies or electronic documents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do. We do provide copying services, scanning services as well. We do provide research. If somebody can't make it down here, we can do the research for them. There is charges for those services, of course. I believe at the Masonic Temple drawings, we duplicate them for you and bring them on this DVD. So we do provide various services, yeah, to the public.
And the quality was terrific. I can account for that. There was I really appreciated having those documents scanned and on a disk, because it's just a great thing to have.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, I'm sure you've seen a lot in the 22 years. But moving forward, does the archivist or archival process, do you see it changing much, or is it one of those things where it's pretty constant in terms of the issues that you face? You know,
I think the big change would be that it's changing. Now, I've so far been lucky not to have to deal with it, but electronic records are still an issue and how to preserve them. I still don't get the sense in a lot of respects that we know how to preserve them for long term. You know, how to make those ones and zeros on a memory stick somewhere be readable 100, 200, 300 years down the road.
I never thought of that. That's really cool.
That's the fear that a lot of this information will eventually get lost over time. Because you have to remember, we're here to preserve documents, the information, in perpetuity with electronic records. Because there's a constant change in terms of hardware and software. Where are we going to be even 50 years down the road, 100 years? You know, is that material going to be available still to the public?
I never thought of that. That's a really cool point.
So that's a great fear and for the Garikawa community as to what we do with this massive information that's heading our way.
So would that mean, for example, like information saved on a USB stick or?
Well, any electronic digital information, however it's formatted. I mean, there's a lot of information that's on floppy disks. Computers don't try to find a computer to read the floppy disk now.
That is really cool. I know that's a neat thing. So how then would that, how that would work? Let's say somebody brings in, you know, a set of floppy disks, and you're not able to find a computer that would run those anymore, which I'm sure we're getting to that point. I haven't seen a floppy disk drive in a long time.
Uh-huh.
Would you just, you know, preserve them in like the best environment and hope the technology returns, or?
Well, or you try to find a service that still can convert those to a more current format. Our computers don't have floppy drives on them anymore. And the newer computers don't even have CD drives or DVD drives on them anymore. So that becomes a problem. So hopefully there's a service out there that can take those old floppy disks, either the 5 1/4 or the 3 1/2, and can still convert those to something that we can read today. We did run across a problem a number of years ago where we got a 3 1/4 flat or 3 1/2 floppy disk from one of the departments, and it was password protected, and nobody at the department knew what the password was. So we couldn't even though we still had a floppy drive, just it was totally useless because we couldn't even open the files in it.
That's such an interesting problem. I never would have thought of that. Yeah, because now that I think about it, I just think in my own life how many random USB sticks, floppy disks, CDs that I've come across, or I've forgotten what's on them, or password protected. It's interesting because I feel like that is a whole different set of problems. I don't know what the actual problems in terms of like the physical structure, whether a USB stick will, if preserved, will last longer than say a piece of paper, but the actual problem of getting to what's ever in there is such a bigger challenge.
Yeah, well,
I feel like it's like the reverse problem. You know, paper, it's maybe hard to store, especially if you got a lot of it. But
well,
easy
that
to access.
Paper is its volume, right? It's the expense of volume. They take up a lot. It takes up a lot of space. We basically know how to preserve paper, so that's not an issue. The issue is space and the cost of storing paper. The opposite with electronic records is there's so much of it because storage costs a little. So you get a lot of volume of information, and then the constant change and evolution of the way to retrieve that information. In the last 25 years, we've gone from 5 1/4 floppy drive to a storage flash drive. You know, 25 years—that's nothing.
Do you have any thoughts on like possible solutions? Should there be some type of is there regulation in place right now governing some of this stuff, like requiring city offices to?
I'm not aware of the city saying. My argument right now for anybody, if it has to be kept in perpetuity, like council minutes or any other document that needs to be kept by law, I would say print them out on paper, and preferably acid-free paper. But I mean, paper better anyways, because we know how to preserve it. The other thing is it takes very little to read paper. You know, to read a document on a computer, on your cell phone or on whatever, there's a lot of technology that goes into allowing you to do that, right? I mean, just beyond the technology of the program, the technology of the computer, the cell phone, you need electricity. So you need the support structure of that as well. there isn't much that you need to support reading a paper document. We've been making paper for centuries. We've been making ink for centuries. All you need is natural light to read a paper document. So it's very simple. So where it gets very complex when you digitize something.
Yeah, I'm just wondering. It's interesting because there's such an emphasis nowadays on going paperless.
And that's being driven more by cost than anything else, and convenience.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about it now. I never thought about this aspect of it before. Yeah, so the paperless craze is definitely there's a cost to it. There's a convenience of not having to print things out. To ask kind of a dumb question or a question you might not be able to answer because who can see the future, but like, so 25, 30 years from now, does yourself and your colleagues in the archival community, are you kind of seeing this problem coming of just so many documents being lost to passwords that have been lost or, you know, technology not being able to read? If you put everything on a USB stick and USB goes the way of the floppy disk.
Well, I mean, I read a number of years ago, the 1960 U.S. Census was put on punch cards. Nobody has a punch card reader anymore. So a lot of that information has been lost off the punch card readers because we don't have them. A lot of, I've heard that, you know, the last decade of the 20th century, more information was lost because of this evolution in information storage than at any time prior to that. I don't know how true that is, but, you know, I've heard that a lot of information has been lost because we can't retrieve it anymore. You know, the files have become corrupted, or the program it's on is no longer readable because we've moved on to other software, or the hardware is no longer available. An example I heard is that Queen's University has the records of a writer, a local Kingston, Ontario writer, and she put it on one of her stories on one of the original Apple computers. Well, they have to save that Apple computer because they have no way of transferring that information off that hard drive to something else. So they've got to keep that one computer going somehow, because once that computer no longer can function, all that information on that computer will be lost.
Do you have any thoughts as to, this is really neat, I'd love to find somebody to follow up with. Anybody watching this, if you are a technology guy or you have some thoughts on this, leave a comment, because I think this is this is just like talking about the archives. You know, one thing I love about the podcast is somebody bringing something up that you weren't expecting, but that gets you thinking. That gets you thinking about it, right?
And this is in a lot of ways it scares me because I mean, I'm always thinking long term. As an archivist, you think long term because you're always thinking, okay, we're preserving this for future generations. And I'm thinking, how do you preserve these electronic records for future generations when you can't even preserve them for a couple of a couple of years, not less a couple of decades.
It's funny. Do you worry that people don't think long term?
Most people don't.
Do you worry about that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What worries you about that?
Well, the simple fact that the information is going to get lost, so that we're not going to be able to retrieve it. One of the solutions being proposed or has been thrown around is migrating information constantly. So as new technologies come out, migrating the information to a new format or whatever you have. And I'm thinking, that sounds nice, but who's going to do it? People just get busy with other things. They don't think about a document that's 10 years old to migrate to a new, you know, program or whatever you have. So it just gets forgotten, and then eventually somebody goes, oh, what was this? And, you know, when they finally discover it, they can't access it anymore. It's inaccessible. So that information is now lost.
The thinking long-term, I think, is something you would have. Being an archivist, you're always going to be thinking long-term, and it's something I've tried to do. Again, with my involvement with the Windsor Masonic Temple, I think the other negative is the right word. negative side of technology is it's really causing everybody to think very, very short term, especially social media. It seems like everything's minute by minute.
Right,
I remember, I can't think of who it was now, but I love space and science and all that jazz. Even though I'm an idiot, I still like to research it. And they were talking about, it's possible to get to, maybe not a human being, but to send a probe out and get somewhere in, far out of our solar system in a couple hundred years. But nobody thinks that's worth it because it's 200 years down the line.
Right.
But meanwhile, you look back in antiquity, Masons, for example, it would regularly you would start building projects that would not be completed until 200 years. You weren't expected to finish a project in somebody's lifetime. Some of these big cathedrals, King Solomon's Temple, it was expected to be 3 or 4 lifetimes before you got to the finished product. Now, if it's not done in 5 minutes,
it's not worth doing.
Yeah, it's too long.
Yeah.
Do you think that, have you always tended to think in the long term, or is that something that being an archivist has really shown you the value of?
I think being an archivist certainly has shown me the value of it. I think I'm trying to remember when I was younger and, the here and now was kind of important and maybe tomorrow wasn't as big an issue. But as you get older, I think you start to appreciate the past more, and how to make sure that past will be around for future generations to appreciate.
And also how what you do today will be around for...
Yes, yeah.
Going back to the point, right? Putting something on a USB stick may be good for you now.
Today, but what about 10 years, 20, 100, 500 years from now?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the...
Like, the oldest document we have here dates from the 1780s. We can read it, I can pull it out, and you can read it easy. Is something electronic, can you go 220 years from now or 240 years ahead with that same electronic document be available to read easily?
Well,
I don't know the
punch cards, right? That's just the 1960s.
I mean, there's all sorts of examples of technology that become obsolete and the information on it has been lost.
I'm wondering if you have any ideas, because there is the paperless, quote unquote paperless craze. Obviously that is a convenient thing. It's a convenience thing, it's a cost thing, right? It's also, I'm sure some are doing it out of the goodness of their, a desire for the environment, for environmental concerns, if they're worried about excessive printing of paper. And I know I've worked in offices where I've been worried as the amount of paper that we're using. But how do we, do you have any thoughts about where the balance is, how you can be cognizant of those things, but also cognizant of the need to preserve these for the future? Even something like smaller fonts, or so you can use less paper?
Is there an environmental damage if it's something you're going to preserve for future generations? You're not throwing it into the garbage or something like that. It's going to be preserved, put away, stored correctly. I'm not sure computers are as green as people want to make them out to be. There's all sorts of e-waste out there that's being dumped on developing countries. I don't want to go down that road.
I think it's a cool road to go down.
It's as green as a lot of, it drives me nuts because people say, oh, it's green. And I'm thinking, if you really start looking at it, it isn't. And those computers and those server farms use up a lot of electricity. And I've read that the internet counts for 10% of all CO2 emissions worldwide. I have a bit of an issue when people say, we're going electronic because it's greener. And I'm thinking, well, I'm not quite sure I buy that argument as much.
And there must be ways to, even something as simple as like printing double-sided, there's ways to mitigate it if the concern.
Well, there's certainly, you don't need to print everything out. If it's an ephemeral item that's, you're looking at it and then that's the end of it, you really need to print that out. But things like minutes of a business meeting or council minutes, so things that you're going to preserve and need to be kept because legally you have to keep them, that to me makes sense in printing those out and storing them correctly and all that. because you're going to keep those. But something you're not going to keep for very long, yeah, I don't see the point in the value of maybe printing that out just because you want a hard copy for a day and you throw it in the recycle bin tomorrow kind of thing.
Thinking of, yeah, just thinking of, you know, the Windsor Masonic Temple again, you know, we, our first, the oldest lodge to meet at the Windsor Masonic Temple is Great Western Lodge. And I can't even think of what it dates to now. It's over 150 years old.
Yes, Great Western Railway arrived, I can speak, in 1854. So sometime around
1854, that time. That's the date. There we go. Because I was thinking 1845, I got them mixed up, and I was like, that's not right. Yeah, 1854 is when Great Western Lodge was founded.
Yeah.
But you can still, you know, find the minute books and the ledger from 1854. Not so much from... you know, I would suggest that I have an easier time finding minutes from the 18th century or the 19th century than I would necessarily from, you know, 10 months ago, necessarily, unless you print them out, if they're on a USB stick.
Well, exactly. Where are they? You know, who's got the USB stick and where is it sitting kind of thing? Where, I mean, don't get me wrong, there's a value to electronic records because, again, you can put them online and then anywhere in the world you can access those records. Where they're on a ledger, you have to physically come to the location where they're housed to look at them. So there's that benefit to dissemination of that information.
I really don't dig that. That's, like I said, that's what I love about podcasts in this format is learning something new, or in this case, recognizing a new problem I didn't recognize before I came in. It's a really cool idea, and I'm just thinking now about what archives will even look like 100 years from now. Will it be a bunch of little drawers? Each drawer has like a USB stick.
It could very well be, or you know, whatever format memory formats are out there, and
there'll be a
that
whole...
could very well be. You know, like I mean, I do have CD-ROMs with architecture drawings on them, and you know, there might be old format computers even to play them or something like that. You know.
And a whole bunch of, you know, a whole room full of you know, obsolete technology and computers and people saying, like, we have no idea what's on these. We keep them in case it comes
back. Well, exactly, yeah.
And I mean, how many things do people just not, you know, just throughout history, like, how many people nowadays would know how to use a floppy disk, a punch card reader? Like, once the new technology comes along, unless you're specialized in the old technology for a specific reason, like you're not going to have a, I'm trying to think what the word is, like a
skill set.
Skill set, yeah, cultural memory of,
yeah.
I mean, how many, you know, if you're a child 10 years old and under, like what's a phone to you, you know?
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, I used to have an old dial phone and a woman came over and she had her child with her and he looked at it and said, I don't know how do you use this kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know? Because he was always used to either punching the numbers in or, you know, not even having to just punch the name and the person they called, that was it, right? Yeah, so, I mean, even that's not that long ago now, really, that kind of memory is being lost.
So, going off this, away from this topic, though I thought it was a really fascinating topic, putting on your archivist hat, you know, a Windsor, any Masonic temple will or should have copies of the minute books dating back to when the lodge was first formed. Mm-hmm. So in the case of Windsor, dating back to 1854, it will also have a register of the names, ages of when they joined, occupations usually, of all of the Masons and Brethren joining, and if there's, say, a Ladies Auxiliary or Eastern Star, same thing. Dues ledgers with the accounts. What type of things could someone learn about their city or their region from those documents?
I'm not familiar with those documents. I really don't...
Or just in general, like... if you had, for example, a listing of the names, ages, and occupations of the members of any club, right? Like, what value do those things have?
Well, I guess first of all, if you were looking through, you see what kind of people are joining us. What socioeconomic group is joining? You know, are they similar age? Are they similar occupational or maybe income levels. You know, so you can certainly get that from that kind of membership list. That information is being kept, so you can kind of, as a historian, look through and say, oh, you know, maybe workmen joined this club, and then you can say, okay, well, what attracted them to this particular club or something like that. I mean, the Great Western Lodge, you know, that was obviously, that was part of the railroad. So you were a railway employee. I have an example of a professor I had many years ago when I was in grad school. He provided an example. At McGill University, they had boxes and boxes of old parking tickets. And they asked the archivist at McGill University, did they want them? And the archivist said, no, it's just a lot of scrap paper, basically. And it got out to one of the sociology professors at McGill saying, oh, I wish you kept those records. And he's saying, what for? What do you need old parking stub tickets for? Like the, you know, violations and things like that, parking violations. He says, well, I could have just studied it, seeing what type of people got parking violation. You know, was it somebody drove expensive cars and basically was thumbing their nose at paying to park the car? Or was it somebody driving a crappy car that couldn't afford to pay the park and things like that? So, I mean, you don't think of what a piece of information could provide to somebody else. So you think it's garbage, and somebody else thinks that's a treasure trove of information they could have extrapolated from that, you know, that piece of paper.
That's kind of what I was getting at, is I think sometimes we Masons, and I'll put Masons kind of on blast here, they don't always recognize the treasure trove of information that they're sitting on, not just for the lodges, but for the city itself. Like, just from a census perspective, what type of occupations are showing up regularly in our records, and in, you know, in 1840 versus 2020, or 18,
right.
You know, just what type of occupations are you seeing? How old are people when they join? Are you seeing, you know, in that time, a younger generation of men joining, whereas now it's an older generation of men joining? And if that's the case, what does that say about demographics and the nature of work? And why is it that people are waiting so much longer to join organizations and clubs? Or I just think
right, and you can just extrapolate, society is generally don't join groups anymore like they did 50, 60, 70 years ago.
Absolutely, yeah. Or, you know, the type of professions.
Right.
Are you seeing consistency? Are you seeing more variety in professions now than you did then? Does that reflect...
Well, you change of occupations, you know, certain jobs disappear over time. So you're looking at jobs that don't exist anymore. You know, how many people are, a buggy maker or whatever, you know, who'd have been a lodge member back in the 19th century. But of course, good luck finding a buggy maker today.
I saw carriage drivers as listing as occupations on some of those records. You know, John Smith, age.
Yeah, or horseshoer or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah.
You did. You saw these occupations that don't exist anymore to have that. I also saw, I think it was a euphemism for unemployed, or maybe like independently wealthy, but a few had their occupation listed as gentlemen.
Gentlemen, yes, I've come across that. And usually I assume that it was more they were well off and didn't have to work. I always took it more as opposed to being unemployed.
That was my guess too.
Yeah.
But have you ever come across in your research any mysteries that you haven't been able to solve? Just because, like, I'll give you the one example. And I wish nobody will know, it's been too long, but I think it was 1915. I was looking through must have been 1925-30. Anyways, the very early minutes of the Board of Masonic Temple Association, which runs the Masonic Temple.
Mm-hmm.
So very early minutes, I was reading my research, just one passage, and it was just two lines, and it said, we have now put a sign designating the women's washroom as the women's washroom. Hopefully the problems will now stop. And that's all they said. And I was like, what problems? Like, what's the story? I can guess, but I'd like to hear a story.
Yes, yeah, exactly. You know, a lot of times with minutes, of course, are very cryptic as to what was going on. They just kind of give you a very broad, you know, you don't get the recording of the conversation that took place. So this, you know, like they said, you know, hopefully that solved the problem, but they don't tell you what the problem was. They precipitated you know, the response.
I mean, were men just going to just pee anywhere? And what is happening in the mid-1920s that had this problem. But what about yourself? Have you ever come across anything that has?
I can't think of anything off the top of my head that kind of said, you know, what was driving that. Yeah, unfortunately, no, I can't think of it off the top of my head right at the moment as to, you know, something that really stuck out and said, where's that coming from, kind of thing. I'm pretty sure there was. It just not well, staying there.
I guess we'll take a look at the in a second in the Masonic Temple blueprints that you were kind enough to provide to me twice now, and I guess three times if you count electronically.
Yeah.
But obviously, we kept the paper. You know, we're keeping the paper ones too. We're not going to rely only on the CD. But if somebody, you know, not, you know, archivist, I guess what advice would you have if somebody is interested in pursuing a profession in either history or archivist in particular? You know, how would you suggest they proceed? Is there, I'm guessing degrees in history are helpful, or museum studies, or?
If you want to become an archivist, then you would need to take an archival program. The closest one in Canada here would be up at Western to their library school. They offer archival classes, and you can specialize in archives. Wayne State did have, I think it still does, I'm not 100% sure, has their archival program, which is a cross with their history and their library school program there. The University of Windsor used to have a program, but it was unfortunately canceled or cut back in 1999. So if you want to be an archivist, you now need to go through, and it's usually grad school, go through usually through the library school. Toronto, like I said, Western has one, Toronto, UBC, I believe it's Manitoba, University of Manitoba, maybe Dalhousie University in Halifax has a program. Yeah, museum, it's a little bit different. They're a different field, really. I mean, they're kind of a cousin to the archives, like library is, but you have to have that, they're different. I don't claim to know anything about being a museum curator, and I know they don't consider, they would know much about archives. So it's just a matter of what field you're interested in.
What would you say are some of the skills required to kind of maintain to maintain an archive? You mentioned, you know, the ability to think long term, which I think would be a very important part of it, or just the you know, thinking long term about things. But, you know, curiosity or meticulousness, or what are some of the qualities that maintain a good archive?
Well, you certainly need to be organized. Having good organizational skills is certainly a I think if you put your mind to it, anybody can become organized.
Never seen my apartment.
Yeah. I mean, if you go into my office, it's pretty disorganized too. So I think an understanding of what's important, because you have to make the decision of what people are going to be researching in the future, because you're going to make the decision of what's going to be saved and what's not, because you can't save everything.
So what's I like that. What's your metric? When asking yourself that question, how do I discern what's important, what's not important? What are some of the metrics that you go by?
Well, first of all, there's basically three levels that you look at. You look at, is it something that requires to be kept? You know, does the law say you have to keep this document? So that's the easiest. The second one, does it have evidential value? It may not need to be kept, but there's information that would be important for somebody to have, whether today or tomorrow or whatever. The third is it a unique item? It might be something that doesn't really have that much interest. It might be like a grocery list from the 19th century. Well, there's not a lot of grocery lists floating around, so it might be just something of interest that's unique and there's not much of it, or say a neat type of paper or print or something like that. So you might just want to keep it just it's one off. You know, there's not much of it around, right? So those are kind of the three. And in my experience, you know, what kind of questions people ask me, what kind of questions have they asked and I couldn't answer because I didn't have that kind of information here. Those are the kind of things I look at as to what should be kept and, you know, what can't be kept or whatever.
And actually that brings us to a good ending point. If, heaven forbid, somebody's parents pass away or grandparents or whatever the case is, or they buy a house and find a box of old documents, is it best to, is it best for them to just call the archives and drop them off, all of them, or some of those questions should they be asking themselves about the documents?
They can ask themselves. It really depends on what's in the collection. I don't want to discourage people. I would say don't just drop them off. Come in, we can go through. Because I may say, some collections may not have a lot of broad appeal. I mean, they're personal collections kind of thing, and they may not really have much of an appeal beyond that. It depends on what the grandparents did as careers, their involvement in the community. I can tell you the collections that are well used here, ones that where the person was very much involved, engaged in the community, was an important individual. And that's not to say that the average person on the street shouldn't also look at donating, because we don't want a skewed history of only important people being preserved, and the average guy working or woman on the street, there's no history of them. They need to be kept as well. So it really just depends on what kind of documents are in that person's collection. That would probably determine whether it's kept or not. But yeah, I mean, certainly give us a call, and we can go from there.
Very cool. I want to, we'll go on to the blueprints in a second, but thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. And I think, as I said, I've had the chance to really think more about the history of our cities and archives and record keeping and those things that I think we far too often take for granted. And, for 22 years, you've been keeping the stories. I know you said it's not your job to create a narrative, but you've maintained the foundation that allows
the primary source.
Yeah, you maintain those sources that have allowed others to create stories of our city or narratives of our city. So 22 years, and I just want to say thank you so much for that and for all your help with myself and providing me with the documents as well.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for inviting me onto your
podcast,
yes.
Whatever it's called.
Whatever, blog, podcast.
All right.
These set came from the building department, and they're copies of the original. And
so I noticed down here, you've got the, bring it over this way, you've got the, like this stamp, right, with the information about the blueprints themselves. So, like the Canadian Bridge Company, how are these archived? Is it archived based on like the name of the structure or location, title of drawing?
It was archived under the Masonic Temple. That's how I found it. Because I wouldn't know who the company made it necessarily, who the architect was. But if somebody like yourself comes in, I'm looking for drawings of their Masonic Temple on Olette Avenue, we would archive it as the Masonic Temple.
So is that how all the buildings are archived, based on like the name of the building itself?
Name of the building, the address, and in terms of architectural drawings, yeah. Because most people, that's how they're going to refer to it. Either, the name of the building, the Paul or the Canadian, the Dominion building, which is now the Paul Martin building, or the address, 185 Olette Avenue.
And then what about the rest of the information that might be located?
Other information would be included in the, would be maybe the architect's name, how many sheets are part of the set. The size of the sheets.
Speaking of, the architect's name for this was Pennington.
Pennington, supposedly, if that's his name on there somewhere.
He's a very prolific architect. You must have a lot of stuff from him.
We do have some, but it's usually through another party. We don't have Pennington stuff directly. We have it through a number of building department drawings. Have his name on it. I think he was a partner with Bill Fraser at one time, so we have some of his drawings through the Bill Fraser collection that we have here.
Maybe move this out of the way.
Sure, I can do that.
So then all of these are part of the same set? Like they're all together?
Yeah, this is all together.
I think this is kind of neat. The so there's Pennington's name, right there, J.C. Pennington, architect, Windsor, Ontario. Oh, I never noticed that before. We got the stamp. What's this seal?
That's probably Pennington's seal.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Job number 956. Does that mean this was the 956th building?
It could be the job, the 956th job they were commissioned to do, whether the building ever was built. I mean, obviously this building was eventually built. I assume it was the consecutive numbering that Pennington did. Or his office did, anyways.
Staircases here. Dude, that's interesting. It says here, was that his office? Bartlett Building? Yeah, it's on all of them.
Yeah.
Where was that located? Do you know?
I think it's either Park or Pitt Street. I think it was Park. It was on.
And we got the first floor mezzanine here. So interesting, because this, like, is all trusses. This doesn't, when you come in the building, everybody who's been in the Masonic Temple will know, right? You come in, I'm guessing these are the front doors here, I would assume.
I would assume so.
Yeah, and then you go up the stairs. Yeah. You can't actually get past here. This would, because there'd be a drop off into the ballroom, which is lower than the main mezzanine.
Okay.
And then this is all the framing. Where's the scale? I thought I saw it on here somewhere. I can't do this for the life of me. I don't know. What is 1/2 equals? Like, is it 1/2 inch equals 1 foot?
Yes. So 1/2, 1/2 inch on this plan is the equivalent of 1 foot in real life. If you wanna...
Okay, so I wish you best of luck, everybody. There's the numbers. You guys figure it out. I guess I don't have to. 15 feet, 42 inches. For this one here. I can't build 15, things.
15 feet, 42 inches. That's,
I don't know what's happening. But I think they're so cool to look at. Like I said, I can't help but when I look at them, imagine, stories and people who've looked through these windows and so this is the north elevation.
And east elevation.
And east elevation. East elevation is the back of the building.
Yes.
The north
would be the Erie Street side. No, sorry.
Yeah,
it's the south side.
The north is where the hunter is.
Yes.
So no one ever sees this side because the hunter...
Because the hunter's right up against it.
Yeah. I noticed this predates the stage because there's now a stage that connects right to the hunter.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, like I don't think you like there's no door or anything. It's but they added a stage in the ballroom.
Oh, okay.
And the ballroom butts up against the north wall.
Oh, Oh, okay.
So they had to push it back. So it's recessed for like band equipment, things like that.
Oh, neat.
Erie Street elevation. I'm guessing that this, it's not there anymore. The rot, I'm wondering if that's where they brought the coal in. Because there's a coal room along down here. Obviously, we're not coal powered anymore, but when it was built in 1921.
Yeah, it would have been coal fired, so for sure, yeah.
So there's a coal room section. I'm wondering if that's where the coal came from. There's also a part here, it would be, where the brick is a different color than.
Oh.
Which I'm wondering if that, did they, that's where they brought the coal in and then.
Maybe, and plugged up the hole at some point in the past.
But I feel like they would have that on here where the coal went. Oh, they got the shininess. There's the front though. You guys can see all these on the video, which I'll make sure to link to. Would you say the majority of your records are architectural, or are they minutes? Or is it pretty much evenly split?
No, it's the majority are textual records. Minutes, minute books, documents of some sort. We have approximately 20,000 architectural sets of architectural drawings here.
How many? Sorry, 20,000?
About 20,000, yeah.
Holy cow.
And we have close to about a kilometer of textual records.
This is the roof. Is that pretty consistent, would you say, at least percentage-wise?
I don't know.
With other cities? Like,
I don't know. I couldn't even give you a guess. It really depends on whether this archives collect, what they have, house. I don't think there's a standard for any archives.
This is the first floor. Lodge. So that actually be the lodge room. So now it would be the second floor, really.
Is it?
Yeah, like the lodge rooms are on the second floor.
Hmm.
I guess it depends how you. Some people call the basement the ballroom, the main floor, first floor, in which case the lodge rooms are on the third floor.
Yeah.
Some people call the where you walk in the first floor, and then the ballroom is.
The
ballroom was
but
sunk.
But it's kind of two floors, kind of. Like it's.
Yeah, the
ceiling's fairly tall. Like yeah. It's not a normal floor height ceiling.
Yeah, it's like a room and a half, basically. Yeah. And then the lodge rooms themselves are another room and a half. And then this would be where refreshment area is and where the learning center is.
Yeah.
And here are the lodge rooms themselves. Lodge room. First floor plan. Scale 1/4 inch equals 1 foot. There you go. I think there's. I'll just go through the last couple. The banquet hall, banquet room.
Okay, there's the cool room. So that would be probably where it gets on the Erie.
Yes, so let's see.
So there's that, right? And then looking kind of where the cool room would be, probably about that area.
So yes, I'm guessing
that might be where they used to the coal chute would have been.
Yeah, makes sense. It says here, if you can get down close, steel door.
Yeah, so that's most likely the coal chute.
There you go. Yeah. Cool. So the coal chute is there. Maybe it's the third window from the east, leading to the coal room. Very cool. And the last one is the, I don't even know what a clan is.
Oh, that's plot plan. That's so the spacing on the site.
Oh, okay.
Why it's called plat plan, I have no idea.
Sheet number one. Very cool. And yep. Now I just have to do this. This is
the archives for the city of Windsor. But before it was the archives, it was Legal Assistance of Windsor, where I articled and spent 2 summers, or 1 summer and 1 semester, working. Legal Assistance of Windsor is currently located on Olette Avenue. Marion Overholt is the director, executive director. She used to be one of the lawyers here and one of my bosses. And she and all the lawyers and all the students I worked with were incredible. Brings back a lot of memories seeing this place again, and I just think it's so cool from my law school days. There you go.